start up here. I think last time we got to Pasuk Yud Daled, which is verse 14. That's chapter 1, verse 14. And we were talking about what they were weeping, why they were weeping so much, and what Rus wept for so much. And we had lots of things to discuss on that. But one of the things that we said is that Rus raised her voice to an unusual level in the fact that she was crying for herself. She couldn't prove to anyone that she was not on the level of Orpah. She couldn't say that to Orpah, and she couldn't prove it to Naomi either. And therefore she felt hopeless, and she cried again. And that's where we also, there was an extra, a missing Aleph, and that also alluded to the other one, Aleph being one, and that was Tamar, who had also been in a very similar circumstance, as we learnt last time. And last time we linked Tamar to Rus. And that's where we left off at the end of last time. Does that all make sense to everyone? That's where we got to. Now we are about to start Pasuk Tesvov, which is 15. Pasuk 15, number 15, verse 15. Just a minute. Okay, that's verse 15. And Orpah is about to return to her old ways. So now that Orpah was leaving her permanently, Naomi addressed Rus by saying she should not think that in her own home it's going to be easy for her to serve God. So Naomi deliberately is speaking to Rus while Orpah was still within hearing distance and saying, your sister-in-law is returning to her people and her God. And she wanted to convey the idea that serving gods was an inevitable consequence of going back to Moab. You go back there, you were going to end up going back to church. It's just, there's no other way. And she was made to understand that if she had any intention on becoming Jewish, at least going back to Moab is not an option. Whether she sticks it out with Naomi or not isn't as vital as her not going back to Moab. And that's why the conversation between Rus and Naomi, which we're going to quote in verse 15, precedes Orpah's return to Moab. But it must be made clear at this point that Naomi did not speak directly to Orpah regarding the matter because she didn't wish to humiliate her by implying that she's going to now go back to idol worship. She only addressed Rus with the hope that her message of warning would make an impression upon Orpah as well, b'derech agav, casually. Does that make sense? It's a very important idea. Very important idea here. I'd like to share with you. One of the most mysterious things that I find personally in the first parak is the unimaginable decline of Orpah. We are told that when Orpah turned round to go back to Moab, she encountered a garrison of soldiers and she was raped by 100 men and a dog on her way back. And you've got to understand who this woman is. What's going on here? She was a princess of Moab. She was the wife of Chilion, a very dignified Jewish leader. And then she wanted to become Jewish along with her sister-in-law and join her mother-in-law on a pilgrimage to Judea Bethlehem in the Holy Land. And then she decided she's not going to do that. It's been a very busy day for her. And she descended rapidly into completely demoralized, terrible situation. How could Orpah, from hugging Ruth and Naomi, turn round and end up so low, so quickly? Now, this is not a question which, of course, has not piquanted the quills of far greater thinkers than I, which is why all I can do is tell you what they've said. Okay, I'll just let someone else answer for you. But it's a very important question because it's an important life message. And it's like this. None other than Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz. Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz explains that when your life's aspirations are shaken to the point of being pulled like a rug from under your feet, and all your assumptions about life and yourself immediately undergo sudden, radical change, you are likely to become mentally disorientated. Said that day, Orpah was resolved to sacrifice her royal privileges to become a pauper in the Jewish nation, in the Jewish land, in the Jewish homeland. That's what she was doing that day, along with her sister-in-law. But Naomi dissuaded her, painting an extremely bleak picture of hardship that she would confront, which certainly in the short term would have been true. So she quit, turned around and turned back to Moab. And everything was changed. And she said, I'm giving up this destiny with Naomi and I'm going back to Moab. But the thing is like this. If you've genuinely toyed with the idea of completely changing your entire being and worshipping a different God, and then you just turn back, it doesn't just stop on a dime and you go back to who you were. You realise you're now not going to be Jewish and you can't really say I'm going back to Moab to be who I was either. So the kasher is, who are you? So she confronted a reality of her own inability to withstand the challenge, and she became disillusioned and demoralized both with Judaism and her own current thought process of being a Moabite princess. It's all a load of rubbish. Everything's bad. There's no good way out of the world. If I become Jewish, I'm up for a destitute, difficult life in Beis Lechem, gleaning for barley as a pauper. If I go back, I can't really say that my life where I'd come from is worth going back to because I was thinking about becoming Jewish. That sudden upheaval caused her to lose all psychological and moral equilibrium. She literally folded. She had a complete mental breakdown. And from that point, there was no limit to how far she could fall. And that phenomena explains many occurrences, even including the sin of the golden calf and Adam's original failure in Gan Eden. The speed of descent of both Adam after the sin and the children of Israel after the golden calf was extreme. And the reason for that is, once they've given up, once they don't know what to do, anything is open game. Once you've made yourself hefka, open, like ownerless, anything, you'll buy into any insanity. And that's now where Orpah finds herself between verses 14 and 15. As she says, I quit. And Ruth stays on. And now we are at verse 15. Tomehine Shova. She said, look, your sister-in-law has returned in earshot of Orpah, who is now walking away. And she's telling Ruth, look at her. She's gone to her people and her God. Once she goes back to her people, I guarantee to you, she'll be going back to her God as well. Follow after your sister-in-law. These are tough words. Sounds like based in here is telling her, go be a pagan or whatever. That's kind of the hardest thing that Ruth has been said to directly, an affront to her newfound way of life, is go back. Now, Naomi thought that perhaps Ruth was so embarrassed that she couldn't leave her and she really wanted to go back like Orpah, but she felt too embarrassed to turn away from Naomi. So Naomi says, look, it doesn't matter. It's no shame. Do what you want. And to test her in his sincerity for the last time, she said, look, your sister-in-law's gone back. You don't need to feel embarrassed. You can go with her. I won't think any less of you. In her own way, this is really weird. And the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh says, she was actually trying to befriend Rus by saying this. Now, that is not a gambit of meeting someone at a club and saying, hi, my name's, would you like to go out for a drink or something like that? How's this in any way befriending her? It's very interesting. With these words, she was eliminating the possibility of Rus voicing a wish to follow Orpah with the intention of continuing to serve God in her home of Moab. By stressing the fact that Orpah was returning to her people and her God, she was indicating that a return to Moab meant 100% guaranteed return to idol worship. And if Ruth wanted to go home, now's the time. But it is possible that Naomi was actually not advising her. She's saying, follow her, but not to her God. Don't be led astray the same way as her. Essentially, the intonation of this verse changes. Instead of saying gently, look, your sister-in-law's returned, you follow after her, it's almost condescending and sarcastic. Look, your sister's returned to her people and to her God. You want to follow after your sister-in-law? That's what she's saying. That's according to the Ibn Ezra and the Al-Sheikh. That's where you're going to end up. You turn around now, that's where you're going to go. Because you should know. It's almost condescending. Verse 16. Vatayimer Rus. But Rus said back to her, very interesting. Al tifki vi, don't push me. I'm translating that. Don't push me, lady. Don't push me. She says, do not press me to leave you. Why? To turn back from following after you. Then there's the famous verse. Wherever you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. Where else do you think you're going to be buried? In another place? Why is she saying that? So may God do to me, and so may he continue, for only death will separate between me and you. All right, these are like some of the most famous verses in scripture, very widely quoted, where you go, I will go. This is it. There's a lot to discuss about this group of two psukim here. Let's just look at Rus's response to Naomi, first of all. Don't push me, lady. Don't push me. I've had enough. What is she saying to Naomi? Naomi, in the past 4 or 5 Pesukim, with the kisses and the talking and everything, essentially has been saying, just let me go back. Leave me alone. Rus is now, frankly, taking no prisoners. She's saying, frankly, this isn't down to you. I'm taking control of the situation. I didn't ask you. I'm now telling you this is what I'm going to do. Rus essentially is saying to Naomi, her mentor, you have been constantly urging me to go back, to test me, to test my resolve. Don't press me anymore. I'm not like her. She finally breaks and says, I'm not like Orpah. I'm serious about conversion. In fact, With or without you, I have resolved never to leave HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This now essentially is a situation where I'm so sure of myself, I'm not really asking you anymore. Michael, it's good you join us. We're now on section 1, chapter 15, and 16 and 17.
Sorry,
don't worry. So it says, don't press me any longer. I'm adamant that from today, wherever you go and wherever you lodge, I'm going to be doing the same kind of a thing. Now, you might wonder why I'm insisting on returning with you. To this I answer, wherever you will die, I will die. I too want to die in the land of Israel. I think I told you last week, it's very painful for the soul to leave the body in Chutz La'aretz. And she has no desire to die now in Chutz La'aretz. There I will be buried. Don't think I'm going to go there without you. So may God do to me, and so may he continue, for nothing but death will separate us. I've got the most incredible Anaf Yosef about this. Unbelievable stuff. This is on the Medrash Rabba, Rus Parshas Base, Aleph Tes Zayin. And it says as follows. Rus was accepting to be buried in the appropriate ceremony. Said Naomi, I've got to start teaching about Judaism. She goes, go for it. She says, if someone is over one of the capital sins, where they're going to get killed, either by strangulation or beheading, which is one group, or internal burning or stoning, which is another group, there's separate places to be buried for them. A regular person is buried in a regular Jewish burial ground. A person who has been killed by one of the court-imposed death penalties has to be buried in a special graveyard just for such people. But there's two levels. Being found guilty of a crime, which is punishable either by strangulation or beheading, is of a lower level of severity than being found guilty of a crime where you need to be burnt or stoned. Now, burning is not burning at the stake. It's where a pipe is forced into the throat of the individual and molten lead is poured down that, because we would never deface the glory of the human body. It's an internal burning, not an external burning. People who are over on those sins, burning and stoning level, such as breaking Shabbos, knowingly, have to be buried in a separate graveyard to the people who were killed by strangulation and beheading. And she told her these laws. And she says, wherever you're going to be buried, I'm going to be buried. I'll be buried in the right way. If that's the way I've got to go, I'll be buried according to Jewish law. She's giving you some pretty hairy stuff here. And she's like, I'm not fazed. All right. If that's what happens, if that's the din, that's the din, that's what I'll do. Says the Anaf Yosef on the Medrash Rabba. So I've got to give you this. The Anaf Yosef. Rus does not answer, where you will be buried, I will be buried. Similar to where you will go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. She says, there I will be buried. He explains that after the corpse of an executed person decomposes in one of these special two cemeteries, that's strangulation and beheading, burning and stoning, the family is allowed legally to exhume the remains and reinter them in their family burial ground. In those days, people had family burial grounds, and it would be unwise for Uncle Bulgaria not to be buried there. After he's rotted, we'll put him to rest in our family burial ground. Hence, someone who was stoned, they put a stone on his grave, by the way. It's a big misinterpretation as to why people put stones on the graves, as to why they put a stone. If someone needed to be stoned to death, they put a stone on their grave to say this person should have died by stoning. It's a very unusual thing that when we visit a grave, people put stones there. It's not a thing to do. Anyway, because Rus would be a convert and she would have no family to exhume her and put her in the family burial ground, she just said, there I will be buried, i.e. forever. Because she realised, if that's the din, if I'm going to be over on a capital sin and you're going to put me in one of these special burial grounds, no one's going to take me out of there. So she, beautiful, enough Yosef on this pasuk. That's why she says, there I will be buried. If that's the din, that's the din. And she's saying, it doesn't bother me. It isn't as if I'm not going to join Judaism just because there's not going to be nobody to look after me. I'm joining. I am serious. So Rus essentially now at this point is converting and she's accepting upon herself the 606 mitzvahs that are additional to the 7 she's already taken on. Hence her name Rus is actually the Gematria 606. The Gemara says they were thinking of calling her Taroi because of the same letters backwards. Rus and Taroi are all the same letters. It gives you 606. It's a Gemara in Yevamos, if anyone's interested, 47b. And she said, Naomi said to her, it is forbidden to walk long distances out of town on Shabbos. She started talking to about the rabbinic injunctions of Tchum. Why is she doing this? Because it's going to affect us this week. We're walking, right, a long way, and we're going to have to stop on Saturday, which is going to put us at great danger. Great danger. So right now, I've got to tell you about Tchum, which is you're not allowed to go 2,000 amos, which is approximately 0.98 of a kilometer, outside of wherever you are when Shabbos comes in, if you're outside of city limits. Your body, you've got 0.98 radius kilometers, which is approximately a 10-minute walk in any direction. Can't go any further than that. If you're in a city, it starts 2,000 amos from city limits. But they're not in a city. They're on a road. So she's got to tell it immediately, Tchum Shabbos, 2,000 amos. What did Rus say? Wherever you go, I'll go. I won't go past the Tchum. You tell me 2,000 amos, I'll do 2,000 amos. She says, right, next up, you're a very beautiful woman. While we're getting stuck on Shabbos, a man might try to seclude himself with you. So she says a private meeting between a man and a woman is forbidden. I'll be Hilchas Yichud. She says, where you lodge, I'll lodge. I'm not bothered by it. Yichud is important and I'll do that. It's fine with me. I've got no problem with it. She says, we have to keep all 613 commandments. You have to do the whole thing. You can't pick and choose when you come to Judaism. You've got to take the lot. She said, your people are my people. Whatever you do, I will do. I'll do the lot. She said, we must not serve to foreign gods. Remember, I told you about this last week. It means you can't get angry and lose control of yourself. She said, your God is my God. Whatever you're telling me, it's not going to shake me now. She's totally steadfast, unlike Orpah, who is utterly broken. Orpah has nothing in her life. Chilion is gone forever. Because there's going to be no Yibam, extra legally or otherwise. She's gone back to Moab. She knows she doesn't believe in that God anymore. But she doesn't believe in God enough to join the Jews. She's empty. Orpah is Araf. Her letters of her name are like Pharaoh. The back of the neck, Araf, Orpah, Pharaoh. All the same letters. She becomes silent and disappears. Ruth is like, I don't care. I'm sticking it out. Naomi said there are four methods of execution. She says, wherever you're buried, I'm going to be buried. It's fine. She's completely committed by this pasuk. People, I want to tell you something, which I'm going to have to cushion for you. Whenever I give this over, especially to ladies, more than men I've noticed, I get very intense reactions. So I used to just say these kinds of things and just get on with it. I'm not going to do that now. I want to get you to emotionally brace yourself for what I'm about to say. I don't mean this in a bad way. I don't mean this in a good way. I just want to tell you what it says in the Zohar Kodesh. But it's going to be quite a shock to a lot of people. Rus and Naomi are having a very deep discussion about something else. And it's alluded to in the Zohar. The Zohar says this is what they're talking about. This is not easy for me to discuss. And it may not be easy for you to hear. And it may go against the grain of what you want it to be. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to tell you. Okay? Because that's what learning Torah and growing is all about. Sometimes you have to have a rub where you're not so happy with what you hear. That's fine. That's fine. You know, someone said to me, sometimes you go see a solicitor or a doctor or an accountant and they tell you things you didn't like. You didn't want to hear that. You know what I mean? That doesn't mean you don't go and see them and you don't value their opinion. The truth is, you know, sometimes... Here we go. Are you all ready for an emotional roller coaster? No, we want to go home. We want hot chocolate. We don't want this. Are you ready? Here we go. Regarding all these various death penalties that Rus has been listing off, Naomi's been listing off to Rus saying, oh, you know, you've got to do this and that, and are you sure you want to go? Yeah, I'm fine with it. There's another way to understand this conversation, brought to the Al-Shech HaKadosh, quoting the Zohar HaKadosh. And the Zohar HaKadosh is in volume 2, page 98b. I'm not making this up. Okay, this is not a Mordechai Goodman thing. This is a Zohar thing, okay? Now, I need you to hear me very carefully. This is a deep thing for our lives. It's why we're here. This is one of the two worth coming moments I've got tonight. Okay? This is a worth coming moment, so stay tuned. When a person is in this world, he's in the process of going. He's active, doing stuff. As it says in Keheles 12:5, that's Ecclesiastes 12:5. For man is going to his eternal home. All people in this world are on a journey. Everybody. Doesn't matter how static they are, they're on the way somewhere. We journey to our destinations. People are constantly on the move from the day of their birth until the day of their death. And life is gradually slipping away. And no one can stop it. The Zohar Kodesh, volume 2, page 98b, says as follows. This is the tough bit. The soul of a proselyte is bound up with the soul of a righteous man, while the soul of a female proselyte is bound up with that of a righteous woman. The Zohar then says, in its introduction to Parshas Vayechi, which was about Yaakov Avinu's blessings on his deathbed that he gave to the children in Mitzrayim, that's in volume 1, page 218a. And it's quoted in a... actually, you also see a Gemara in Kasubas 104a, says follows. Now, you need to really focus here. When a person goes to his eternal home on high, all those that are to be his neighbours in his new home come and lead him to his place. And this is learned out from a verse in Deuteronomy, Devarim 32:50. And he was gathered unto his people. You may have heard of that as a biblical expression to say he's dead. Gathered unto his people. What does that mean? Just say he died there and they put his body in the ground. What does it mean he's gathered unto his people? That's what it means! His soul is gathered unto the new neighbours who are going to be his family in the next world. It says in Numbers 27:13, that's Bamidbar, Chof Zayin Yud Gimel, and you shall be gathered to your people. When Moses dies, when Aaron dies, and they were gathered to their people. Those who share that place in the next world are called your people. They themselves, those souls of the departed, gather this new arrivee and lead him to the appropriate place in the soul world. That's your family. The family you have here is genetic. But the family you earn for yourself are those individuals who have reached the same spiritual plateau as you based upon the choices made. That's your real mishpocha. Your family are the ones on your level that you've made for yourself. Now we can start to maybe understand some of these words. Where you die, I will die, and I'll be buried. It says, your people are my people. I.e., because my soul as a proselyte woman is bound up with you, I accept that wherever you die and gather to your people means I'm going to be stuck with you, because my soul is now bound up with you. And I'm accepting my fate, both in this world and in the hereafter, that my family and my people will be whoever hangs out with you in Olam HaNeshamos, in the world of souls. And I'm happy to do that too. Wow. That's what Rus is saying to Naomi. Don't push me. I don't care what's happening. I'm totally committed in this world and the next. Even though I'm losing all my family, both halachically, I'm now no longer considered to be a member of their family. I still have to show them honor, because the halacha says people will think that by joining Judaism you become an ingrate if when you convert you don't show your biological family honor. So you have to show them honor to avoid being looking as an ingrate. But halachically, you're not under kibbutz and kibbutz and stuff like that. But you still have to show them honor as much as is necessary, but you're not allowed to go back and live with them, because we are very genuinely concerned you'll fall into your previous ways. So you must limit how much you have to do with the previous family member. Naomi's saying it's not just that far. Whoever my family is upstairs is going to become your family. You ready for that? Yep. I'm ready for that. Also, there's a Medrash Tanchuma that quote in Parshas Toldos, I sign, that's Parshas Toldos section 7, that God does not attach his name to a righteous person until they've died. Our sages say that even though it's considered honourable to be buried in the land of Eretz Yisrael, it is all the more beneficial for the soul if he actually dies in the land of Eretz Yisrael, because you cannot compare giving a soul back to its mother versus giving it back to a stranger. And that is a Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi on Kesubas 12:3. So Rus said, where you die, I'll die. You want to go back to Eretz Yisrael? I'm going to Eretz Yisrael. I'm not going back to Moab. I'm not going back to Moab. She's saying, don't press me to leave you, because any further attempts to dissuade me on your part will only serve to indicate that you suspect me of having evil intentions, and that I'm not fitting. But if I was so inclined, wherever you go, I will go. I would never have said. I'm certain that wherever you're going, my soul is also going to end up to. You can't get rid of me. I am now attached to you soul-wise. Where it says, where you will lodge, I will lodge. She's talking about her place in Olam HaNeshamos. Wherever your lodging will be in the soul world, that's where my lodging will be, because I'm bound up with you. And there's nothing you can do anymore. So she, just like Naomi, is being quite stark, saying to Orpah, look, there she goes back to her gods. Why don't you go with her? Rus turns around and says, oh yeah? I got news for you. You can't shake me. Now that I'm completely committed, there's nothing you can do. I'm bound up with your soul, whether you like it or not. Wow. Only death will separate us. What does that mean? Listen to that. Do you hear these words? You've got to listen so carefully. death will separate us. What is she saying? The son, which will result from the extra legal levirate marriage, I'm willing to do as a chesed for you, will be imbued with the spirit of your son Machlon. Whether now, while I have that spirit of your son in my body, or whether later, when that neshama will be transmitted from my body to the fetus of my son, there will always be a bond between us. And that would not be possible if I were to marry anyone else but someone who would be in line for Yibum, even extra legally, as we discussed last week. Because as the spirit of Machlon would leave me, I would lose all connection to you even before Machlon really dies. Only death will separate us. If I die before I manage to do Yibum, that will truly separate us, because then I'll lose my connection to Machlon. And that still means I'm technically your daughter-in-law, because his soul is within me. And when I give that soul over to the next generation, I'm still your daughter-in-law. For now, I become the mother of your son, which makes us like sisters, right? If she has levirate marriage and gives birth to Machlon as Oved, Naomi also gave birth to Machlon as Machlon, which means now Rus is elevated up to a level of sisterhood to Naomi. Do you hear that spiritually? Only death would separate us, because either I'm your daughter-in-law or I'm your sister, but if I die and I haven't done it, then you can truly say we've lost everything. Because we're connected by this soul, Machlon, who I harbour. All this is being said. All of this is in the subtext. We're on verse 18. Verse 22 is the end of the perek, I'd like to point out. Verse 18. But she saw that she was steadfast in her decision. Rus, by this time, Naomi is bowled over. She's like, wow. Okay. After hearing all that, she's like, okay. You're all right. You're from. Okay. Whatever. Okay. You're in. You know what I mean? So she stops speaking to her. There's no point dissuading her from here on in. Rus has slammed down totally authoritatively the final hammer blow, so that there's nothing you can do about this anymore. So Naomi's like, all right, the conversation's over then. Very unusual. I'd like to point out, very unusual. If you went to a doctor, a solicitor or an accountant, and they kept nudging you not to do something, don't make this investment, don't take that medication, don't take that legal course of action, what kind of response, what kind of result would that have with you? I would have thought the more they nudge you not to do it, the more you're going to become eroded to come around to their way of seeing things. Only with Pharaoh do we see like an egg, his heart got harder and harder. So too, Pharaoh Orpah, say Moses, Rus became harder. The more she was being told, don't convert, don't convert, don't convert, the firmer was her resolve to convert. Naomi realized there's no point saying anything. The more I tell her not to join, the more steadfast she is to join. Completely unlike Orpah. What did Naomi realize at this moment when she kept silent? She realized for sure that Rus is the good dove who's going to be a convert from Moab. Do you know what that meant for her? She got the reason why she's alive. And only now did she get it. Her husband and her sons had died. Her unborn Vlad, her fetus, had miscarried. And she expected very much to die too, as is the way of everyone else in her family, when the fist of Hashem, the hand of Hashem with the five afflictions that we talked about last week, smacked her. Says, the fist of God is against me, the five fingers. Those are the five afflictions she suffered. Why is she not dead? She expects herself to die. Now she's got a reason. I'm here for her. This clearly right now is the visionary moment for Naomi as to why she survived the entire thing. She's only there for this woman. She now realizes that she simply is alive because of this hang-along that she's got with her. If it wasn't for her, she'd be dead. So she kept shtum. There's no point me telling her anything. She's the reason I'm alive. And she realized that. Let's look at Yutes, Chof, and Chof Aleph. That's 19, 20, and 21. The two of them went until they arrived in Beis Lechem. And it happened that when they arrived in Beis Lechem, the whole city was in uproar about them. And the women said, could this be Naomi? That ragged old woman, that's like the princess of Ephraim? That's her? She replied to them, don't call me that. Don't call me Naomi, but call me Moira. Bitter, like Loshen Mar, Maro. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I left full. We discussed this pasuk earlier, that she's pregnant. But God has returned me empty-handed. Why should you call me Naomi, pleasant one, since God has testified against me and has dealt very bitterly with me? So we've already touched on some of these ideas earlier on. But there's real questions on Naomi's statement here. First of all, the word, if you have a look in the second word of verse 19, shtehem, they, the two of them. Two of them, why couldn't Shmuel Hanavi just wrote the word, they went, for Tolchona. First word, drop the word two of them. They went, the two of them. Just say they went. Who else are we talking about for 19 verses? Another thing is, shtehem is in the masculine. He should have written it shtehen, finishing with a nun in the feminine, because we're talking about two women, not two men. If you read this in English properly, it said the two men went. That's how you'd read this. You'd be like, you'd be screaming at me, going, what do you mean the two men went? It says the tense, and the two of them went, the two men went. There's no men here. Why? It should say him in the masculine. The same thing about the word alehen. If you look at the word alehen, that alehen is in the feminine. So why, when it says about them, did we go back to the feminine, which is correct? And in the beginning, we're in the masculine. Also, we read that they went to Beis Lechem, and we are further informed that they arrived there. Where else would they have arrived if they were going to Beis Lechem? They went to Beis Lechem, and they arrived there. Is that... you know what? In fact, you could take the word Beis Lechem entirely. We know where they were going from many Pesukim ago. Just say they got there. You'd have to look up. Six Pesukim ago, they were on their way to Beis Lechem. It's the Mashman Beis Lechem. They went to Beis Lechem, they got there. And what was the uproar? Why is the whole town in uproar? How were they surprised to see Naomi and Rus? First of all, they didn't even know who Rus was. And two, his Naomi was unrecognizable. They shouldn't have done anything. It should have said they got there and nobody recognized them. That's what it should have been. Then verses 20 and 21 start discussing Naomi's name. And what it should or shouldn't have been. How is this in any way relevant to us? Is it the usual way that you open up a chumash and it starts to relate the gossip of the women folk of the town?
Yeah, she said she had two dresses.
Who cares? The Torah doesn't waste your time talking about gossip. By the way, why is she complaining that she returned empty-handed when she didn't say she lost her husband and two sons? Wouldn't you have thought that would have been the most important thing to have said? Oh, don't be shocked. I've had a really tough time. Yeah, I lost quite a bit of money. What about our whole family? Unbelievable, no? I mean, the whole thing doesn't make sense, frankly. It's like this. When they embarked on their journey, they did not seek the company of other people, as normal women would do in such a circumstance, to gain some kind of protection from attack. They're two women, completely alone, where there's no police force in between Moab and Yehuda, no one, and one of the women is startlingly attractive. What do you think's going to happen? What happened to Orpah? And she was just turning around and going back down the road. The two of them went masculine emphasizes that only the two of them traveled. No one else was in their company. That's why it's in the masculine form, shatehem with a mem. And that indicates they went out like two men that are willing to go traveling somewhere by themselves without fear. Like two, they're not worried about getting molested. They're two strong warriors. Someone wants to pick a fight with us. I got my gun. I got my sword. I'll kill him. They were that resolved. They were like two men strutting down the street. When they arrived at Yehuda, however, the people who witnessed them as the women they were revert to the word aleihen about them in the feminine. Because as far as they're concerned, they see two women, not two strong Zaftic men. You know what I mean? The town was in uproar, not about their identity, but about the fact that two women had travelled all the way from Moab, barefoot, they had no money for shoes, alone. In addition, they were a little surprised to see Naomi back in Yehuda, thinking that she'd never show their face there again. These women were treading an exceedingly dangerous path. There's a Gemara in Sota 42b that says that Orpah had travelled the distance of 2,000 cubits, which is approximately 0.98 kilometres, as we said earlier, in order to go home. But during that short time, which I said to you, I worked out, because when I travel around in places that I don't have tchum, I have to work out the tchum for where I'm going. Worked out 0.98 kilometres is approximately a 10-minute walk in a single direction. And in only that 10-minute walk, she'd been repeatedly assaulted until she was beaten and bruised like corn. Naomi travelled barefoot alone for 7 days through a Shabbos. They had to stop at Tchum. And it was quite likely that the Medrash says they put on men's clothing. They dressed up as men for the duration of their journey. And that would also, of course, explain Shneihem masculine. Once they reached Beis Lechem, hometown, they had to get rid of those male clothing because of laws of Lois Silbash. You can't wear a man's clothing. They only did it to protect their lives. Thus, all the inhabitants saw them dressed as women. So it goes back to being feminine. No wonder the city was in uproar. They saw two attractive women arriving from a faraway place, completely on their own, through a 7-day journey and surviving completely unharmed in a place, as we'll learn, where even Boaz had to tell the farmhands to not molest Rus because that was normal in those days in Israel, let alone on the road to Moab. Interesting. That's Shneihem. That's why it's in the masculine. Is everyone comfortable as to why the word Shneihem is in the masculine now? Is everyone okay with that? All right. Essentially, Naomi is acknowledging her guilt to all and sundry when she comes home, saying, yeah, we completely made a mistake. First of all, I should never have left. Second of all, I should have convinced my children not to marry out. And she's saying, midah keneged midah, Hashem struck me back for doing that. She says, don't call me Naomi, as if my woes were pleasant, because you might have made me bitter. Proof for this is I left pregnant, and if I was truly meritorious, I would have had that child. Yet, unfortunately, I miscarried, and he died like my husband and the other sons because of my guilt, and therefore there's no reason for you to call me Menahomi, because my deeds aren't pleasant. And you may say, how can you deny it? We know you as the very famous, righteous, good-intentioned, beautiful woman that we knew you before you left. And her reply is, God has testified against me. That's what she said. Because we know that Hashem looks into a person's inner thoughts, and that's how he deals with people. Verse 22. This, by the way, is the end of the first parak. Naomi returned with Rus, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who had returned from the fields of Moab. It's like none of that is necessary. I think every one of us now would just take an eraser and delete all of that. They came to Beis Lechem. We can delete that. The only new piece of information is that they're onto to the barley harvest. Can you see that? That's the only thing we need from this verse. Is that they should have just said they arrived at the onset of the barley harvest. There is nothing else that should be in that pasuk. Does that make sense? Every other piece of data in that verse has already been thoroughly worked through prior to verse 22. Does everyone agree with that? We know that both Naomi and Rus had returned from Moab. And we know that Rus was Naomi's daughter-in-law. And we know that they turn up to Beis Lechem. And here's the big shock. At first, Naomi is mentioned before Rus, denoting the fact that she's more prominent. Yet later in the verse, they're mentioned together. They came to Beis Lechem. The Hema Ba'u Beis Lechem. The two of them as one. So Naomi and then Rus. And then later in the verse, it says they're both equal. This is one of the most revealing psukim in the whole perek. It teaches us how much Rus had grown and gained from her 7-day journey with Naomi and her entire journey from marrying Machloim. Just by leaving Moab and coming to Yehuda, this proselytess had grown spiritually exponentially. When she left Moab, Naomi was definitely the more prominent figure. And that's why she's mentioned first. When they left Moab, she left the daughter-in-law. Rus was very much a Moabitess, and her only relationship to Naomi was that she was her daughter-in-law, although not halachically. Once she had converted, as far as Hashem was concerned, she'd taken on a completely new status. And by the time the woman reached Beis Lechem, she's Naomi's equal. She's a brand new spiritual entity. Now, with that explanation, we are far better placed to understand what it means for Tosh of Naomi, and Naomi returned. At first, Naomi was considered to be of a very great stature, and Rus was a Moabitess, inconsequential, whoever, some Goyish princess. When they arrived in Beis Lechem, Rus had become a Jewess and was now equal. They came together. Indeed, Naomi had survived twice due to God's kindness, because she played a part in her husband's sin, either in leaving the land of Eretz Israel or not forcing him to pray for others, and in not convincing her children to marry out. Now we're told the reason why she was not destined to die. Naomi returned. She did not die like her husband, and her sons and her unborn son, even though she was guilty to an extent of the same sins that killed them. She was allowed to survive to pick up Ruth the Moabitess, who was destined to join the ranks of Israel and give birth eventually to David. Naomi was now deemed worthy in dint of her role as being Makar of Ruth, and she was awarded the big schus of being the one that brings Ruth into the fold of Judaism. And that's what it means she returned. That's her tshuva. What's Naomi's tshuva? Bringing Ruth back. Minikineg admitted she didn't say anything about her sons marrying out. But now, to go opposite that, she's brought Ruth into Israel. So she's done tshuva. Naomi's returned. The first two words are Naomi's done tshuva. Naomi has returned. She's returned to the spirit. She's done tshuva. Now, here's the secret mystical bit. Not only did the two women come to Beis Lechem, but there was a male with them as well. Machlon was in Rus's innards. And that's why it says the word Vahema, they, which is just generally plural. It could be y'all. It's like an American, y'all. Y'all coming back to Beis Lechem. Who's y'all? Rus, Naomi, and Machlon. Machlon's coming home. Machlon could not come home on his own two feet. He has to be piggybacked in Rus's innards. And the arrival in Yehuda is now reckoned as of secondary importance to the arrival of Machlon's spirit. There's a prince of Ephraim walking in with these two women. That's why their arrival is a hema in the masculine and not in the feminine. Oh, why are we in such uproar? The prince of Ephraim has returned. How interesting. That's all in the gender of one word. Here's the second reason, the second worth coming moment. This is it. The first worth coming moment was the whole thing about who your family is who your deeds get you to. Here's the second moment. It's a big question on the Medrash in Rus Rabba, which is as follows. It links with Pesach. Remember, Pesach to Shavuos is barley harvest to wheat harvest. Right? Barley harvest is Pesach, wheat harvest is Shavuos. And there was an Omer, you count Svira, in between Pesach and Shavuos. How many days were Ruth and Naomi traveling? 7 days. That was their Svira between Pesach and Shavuos. And at the end of it, Ruth accepted the Torah. Can you see a theme running here? Can you see a theme? At first glance, this concept of who returned to the fields of Moab is meaningless. However, Chazal says something unbelievable. This is a worth coming moment. It's worth setting aside your evening a bit. Why is the word returned used in connection with Rus, who had never been to Israel in her life? Only Naomi has returned. Rus has not returned. Rus has never been to Israel. It just said Naomi returned, not the two of them returned. Secondly, why is there a definite article when we talk about their return? We say that they're coming back. Hashava, that they're returning. It seems to imply that Rus was returning. The point is being made is that Rus is the one who, even though she's never been to Israel, is reckoned as a returnee because of Machlon that she carries. He had been in Yehuda, and his returning is her returning in the masculine. Her returning is more about his returning. She's a vector to bring him back. There's a Medrash that says, Rav Shmuel bar Nachman said, each time the term barley harvest is mentioned, it refers to the reaping of the Omer, which is on the second day of Pesach. A sheaf of barley is waved on the altar and a burnt offering is sacrificed before the new season's grain can be eaten. That's a mitzvah, actually, in Vayikra 23:9, Leviticus 23:9. The Targum renders this verse, if you have a look at the Targum, and they came to Beis Lechem on the day before Pesach. The day when the Israelites are preparing to give the Korban Omer and wave an offering consisting of barley. The question here is, what difference does it make whether they arrived on Erev Pesach or... who cares? Why is it relevant to us to know that on the day they prepared to reap the barley harvest? And why is the Targum at such pain to tell us that on the day the Israelites were preparing to reap, wouldn't it have just been okay to say it was the reaping of the Omer? No, they were getting ready. It was Hachana. The Medrash in Pesikta Rav Kahana, number 12, says, just as a girl who was in captivity and a newly converted female proselyte must wait 3 months before marrying in order to distinguish between the unclean and the holy, so too Israel had to wait 3 months after leaving Egypt before they could receive the Torah. People, listen to me. Let's say a young woman converts to Judaism, and the second she walks out of Beis Din, she gets engaged. How do you know if she gets pregnant that she wasn't pregnant from someone prior to her conversion? What we say is, you're new, you're fresh to go, but you have to wait 3 months. And by that time, once you've ended your first trimester, we'll know that that child that you're bearing was a child prior to your conversion, conceived prior to your conversion, and when he or she is born, they are not immediately considered Jewish, born to a Jewish mother. But if we see after 3 months, you're still skinny and you are not pregnant, then we know for sure whoever you'll marry will be a child conceived after your conversion, and like any person born of a Jewish mother, is automatically considered Jewish. So too, Klal Yisrael had to wait 3 months.
No, 49 days.
49, okay. What are we talking about? What are we saying? It's like this. It says, after they left, they had to receive 3 months. Because if you add up all the time that they were actually free, before they got the Torah, it was a full 3 months. They were not under Pharaoh's remit, all in all, for 3 months. That's the Pesikta to Rav Kahana. This is why you can understand what Rav Shmuel bar Nachman was saying. She stayed close to Boaz's girls, gleaning until the end of the wheat harvest. In the second perek, verse 23. That's 2:23. Why? The intention of the Medrash is informing us at the end of the wheat harvest marked a period of 3 months since Rus had converted, and that's the day her mother-in-law told her, now we got to get you married. We got to wait. Now that the 3 months necessary to distinguish between the seed conceived before your conversion and after your conversion is over, that day I'm going to seek out a shidduch for you. So Rav Shmuel is saying that when it says the reaping of the barley harvest is the Omer, he's telling you this information is to tell you that now the day they got there to the day that she got their shidduch with Boaz was a full 3 months. It was all legal. It's interesting that Klal Yisrael also needed an Omer period, a Sfirasa Omer, because we had walked out of Egypt filthy. Did you know the sea wanted to drown all the Jews? Because there was a little boy called Micha who had an idol in his pocket as he was crossing Yamsuf. And the sea said to Hashem, I wish to drown the Jews because they're still worshipping idols. There's a kid here with an idol in his pocket. And Hashem said, but they're on the way to get my Tyre. That boy Micha was none other than the little boy who Moses had spared from being thrown into a brick to be able to make one of the bricks of Ramses and the storehouses, which Moses spared. And he was the one that told Aaron to make the golden calf. Better he would have died in the brick. But Moses spared him. Nobody would have told Moses he was wrong. God said, leave them all alone. I know who they are. Don't spare them. So Klal Yisrael were compared to a woman who had to wait before she could get the Torah to rid herself of the unclean influence of Egypt. And that's why the 7 weeks began with the Omer, to remind us that before we become purified, we're unclean, as an animal that feeds on barley. Then when you get to Shavuos, it's wheat, which is human fodder. It should not surprise us that Rus was deemed suitable to give birth to David, because she was brought to our people at a time of the reaping of the Omer. Why? So that she too could begin the purification process with Naomi's help for 3 months. Her arrival at this time of year reminds us that just as barley was reaped before Israel underwent the purification, so too Rus underwent a similar process before she was ready to play her part in the destiny of Israel. That's why it was the preparing to reap the Omer. It's all about the work of Sfirsa Omer. Rus, after undergoing that purification, went through this procedure, and it was therefore ordained by God that she arrive in Yehuda Dafka at the time of the Korban Omer to begin the time of Sfirsa Omer, so that by the end of Omer Shavuos, which is when we read this, she's ready to look for her Shidduch and give birth to Ovid, Yishai and Ovid. She's also got to do Sfirsa Omer now. And that has set up chapter 1. So we got from literally nowhere, from Elimelech and Naomi leaving Israel during a famine, all the way back to Naomi and Rus back, ready to start her beginning as a Jewess in Israel. And the second Perek's the real packed Perek, where now she's going to find her way in Israel, find Boaz, and give Mahlon a second chance. With this, we have finished the first Perek of Rus, which includes within it incredibly deep ideas. Incredibly deep ideas. Global, outside of Shavuos, outside of Geras. Global ideas for everybody. I really look forward, Be'ez Hashem, to continuing this journey through us with you. There's so much to see and do. And we're starting to get to grips with the mystical elements, the physical elements, the growth elements as to what they're doing. And please, God, we'll continue next week.